welcome to the 85th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as the US election nears, welcome to the podcast that's still unconvinced whether either candidate is going to be any good for cricket.
We are, however, planning to take a leaf out of Donald Trump's book and to flood the market with a whole load of Reverse Rep Radio caps for all of our adoring fans. Don't worry, we're not going to talk about the US election, I don't think, ever again in this podcast. Or, you know, well, maybe if Trump wins and the world goes to pot, maybe we'll have to talk about it. But we've got all kinds of other things coming up, including a little bit of a roundup of the, as ever, of the things that have caught our eye in the last couple of weeks. Andy's going to be talking to us about one of the most bizarre and most disputed forms of dismissal in the game. We're going to be reviewing How's That, the story of Kerry Packer, the television documentary, as well. Now, Andy, it's been a few weeks since we recorded. What's been catching your eye in the world of cricket?
Well, Friday was an almost emotional day for me when Zafar Ansari made his debut for England, and it meant that I can now say that I've played cricket with an England test player. So the background is that Zafar played alongside my younger brother in a team, and I played in several games against them and netted with him on a fair few occasions. He was an absolute prodigy at that stage. You know, he was always playing age groups above himself.
How old were you then? How long ago was
so,
this?
So, I was 13 and he was 9 and my brother was 11.
Right.
So, he was already playing a couple of years above him in an age group. At that stage, he was actually a quick bowler. So, he's obviously then gone and converted into a spinner. He was already at that stage making tons and tons of runs. Funnily enough, I spoke to someone only yesterday who had played with him at Cambridge University and said that the real standout thing about him was his temperament. They said just unbelievably calm and composed, and as a spinner, always willing to try new things in games. So I thought that was very interesting. I've already had the pleasure of watching him on quite a few occasions at the Oval, and I found that very weird because, you know, it's already strange seeing someone you know just out on the pitch at the Oval. But this was far stranger. I think for all of us who follow the game, Test cricket is a far-off, unobtainable land, and, you know, the idea that someone you've once shared a net with could be playing there is slightly bizarre. But no, wish him
it
all
is
the best.
Because we do kind of think of Test cricketers as kind of slightly superhuman in many ways, you know, particularly because nowadays to be at that level as a sportsman, you have to lead a particular kind of life. You have to obviously be ridiculously good at your sport as well. And so sometimes there is that dissent that there's that massive gulf between us and those other kind of superhuman beings, which
absolutely.
Is exactly as you say, is kind of bridged when you know them. Are you planning then on becoming the kind of the club bore who, whenever anyone talks about England Test cricket, you go, "Oh, do you know, I once, you know," and you've got to make up a story, of course, about having cover driven him for 4 or something, you know, it was his quicker ball and you just effortlessly lent on it and sent it to the boundary. Is that a danger of what you're going to become with this connection?
I absolutely am going to become the club bore. I'm going to churn that story out again and again. The really annoying thing is that I actually don't have the cracking, pithy anecdote. I actually can't remember anything specific. As I said, I played in a few games with him. I've netted with him a few times, but I cannot remember a single specific incident. I'm going to assume, on the basis of my general cricketing career, that he probably bowled me out on many occasions and probably hit my bowling for a lot of runs. But that doesn't quite work as a pithy anecdote, does it? So
you've been bowled out so many times that you probably don't remember about that. Remember specific instances anyway. But anyway, more on you getting bowled out cheaply later on, I'm sure. So here in Australia, there's been, over the last few days and the last couple of weeks, there's been a bit of a kind of media storm, I suppose, that's been brewing, which has been spurred on by the publication of two new autobiographies, Michael Clarke's and Mitchell Johnson's. These are obviously big commercial properties. They released just in time for Christmas. The various publishers are very keen to get behind them, so they've been releasing excerpts in various newspapers. They've also been going out. Johnson and Clark have been going out and giving lots of interviews and things like that. And actually, I, you know, sometimes I kind of think, oh, do we need to turn cricket into a media circus? But I've actually really enjoyed the way in which there's been this big media storm that's been kind of blown up around it, because so often cricket's attitude towards the media and players' attitudes towards the media is just absolutely sort of anodyne, and any question just gets batted back with, I have the greatest respect for them and they're a great player, kind of, you know, how did that feel? It felt great, kind of, you know, question-answer situation. And what's great here is that there have been recent real-life situations that have really come to life in a quite kind of honest way. So, for instance, in Clark's book, he talks a lot about the fact that, you know, the Kolkatic relationship, and he talks a lot about how they, you know, eventually made up and they actually deep down had a lot of respect for one another. And Kolkatic has come out in the press and just said, basically, that is absolute bollocks. And we don't have any respect for one another. I can't stand aside from we've never said a nice word to one another. Similarly, Johnson in his book comes out with all kinds of accusations, particularly around Mickey Arthur and then around Clark, around the kind of culture in the team that they brought out. And I actually think it's fantastic that suddenly there's this honesty that's really out there in the world.
I guess what's interesting is, I mean, how much of this has come out, how much of this has been a genuine shock in terms of the response to the Australian public? Because a lot of this has been known, to some extent, been known. What's the response been like?
Have
people been surprised, or have people been like, yeah, we kind of knew this already?
I don't think it's a surprise, but I think it's kind of a gladness that people are actually talking about it, because in the past you'd have these incidents and they'd be kind of rumored, you know, these rumored dressing room bust ups or whatever it is. But now for the players to actually come out and talk about this directly and put their feelings on the record quite directly is actually a very different thing, I think.
You know, the other thing that I just find really interesting is that a lot of parallels here with the England team and the whole Kevin Peterson thing and the divisions and there. And in both cases, you've got teams that have basically been very successful. I mean, if you were to look at England Australia over the last decade, both those teams have had an awful lot of success. Yep. And you think, well, this idea that you necessarily need a united, unified squad where everyone loves each other, it's not actually essential, is it? You know, both these teams have achieved an awful lot while, you know, as you say, you know, Clark and Katic hated each other, Mitchell Johnson couldn't stand the coach, and in spite of all that, they kind of got on and got a lot done.
I suppose the issue is always when things then don't go right, that's often when those cracks start appearing. So it's easier to hold a group of people together when you're winning, but as soon as you start losing, then that's when those cracks kind of become much more significant. Earlier on, we were talking about your getting bowled out by Zafran Ansari, but it's not only England Test cricketers, I think, who are able to get you out cheaply.
No, and that ability of mine almost led to recognition last Friday. So last Friday night was the very prestigious end of season award ceremony at Pinkney's Green Cricket Club. As mentioned previously on this podcast, this season has not been one of... it's been higher on fun rather than runs for me. So I wasn't expecting to be in the running for any of the multiple trophies on offer. But then I noticed that this year's ceremony had a new addition, a large yellow duck-shaped trophy, and I think you could work out what that was for. aware that I'd picked up, and I honestly couldn't remember, and I think it's a bad sign of the season you've had when you can't even remember the number of ducks you've had, but I thought I've had two or three, certainly. And my teammates were soon rather ungenerously hinting that I could be in danger here. Fortunately, I needn't have worried. One of my colleagues had picked up four and had comfortably outdone me. But actually, I was a bit sad. When I saw the trophy close up, I actually kind of fancied winning it. It was a kind of spectacular thing. I'll tweet it out. I'll tweet a photo out of it on our feed later so people can appreciate its majesty. But I was actually thinking I'd quite have enjoyed having that on my desk, and I could have dealt with the humiliation in exchange for having it on my desk, I think.
And in a way, you know, it's a curious form of silverware, mostly because it's yellow and it's shaped like a duck. But in a way, we'll take any silverware at our level of the game, frankly. I mean, I'd love to just be able to say that I got a trophy, and that's what I tell most people. I was given a trophy at my cricket dinner last week. Everyone, you know, would misinterpret it as they would be so inclined.
But one of the problems we have, which I think many clubs probably have, is we have a couple of really standout players. So we have one phenomenal batsman. And the award ceremony does occasionally risk becoming, and again, and again. And then
it's like at school where there's the smart one who wins the Buddy Mass Prize and the, you know, Science Prize and even the Art Prize. You know, they just win everything.
Well, that was me and you, know, right, Toby?
Better than I. Well, look, I mean, yeah, in my revisionist view of history, it definitely was me. The record books may show something else.
Now you are still at a stage in your cricket season where you can be going out and putting in the performances that will get you those end of season rewards.
Yeah, well, look, so we've obviously the cricket season just starting off here in Australia. We've played. I play for the ABC team, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation team, which is where I work, and we've played a couple of games. I haven't. I mean, I scored a 30 and a 20 or something like that. So I haven't been covering myself in glory. But actually, the first game of the season. Usually, I get really excited about the first game of the season, but this year I unfortunately woke up on the Sunday morning. The game was at 9:30 on a Sunday morning. I woke up at 9. I think I'd gone to bed at about 5. I woke up at 9, and let's just say that I was still rolling on from the night before. My body still thought it was rolling on from the night before. So I got out onto the pitch, and it was boiling hot. Couldn't think of anything worse. I had to keep through the entire first innings without barely being able to kind of bend down. We play this last man stands form of cricket where it's eight-a-side teams. And you can bat until you reach 50. At 50, you have to retire, but you can come back in at the end. And the team that we were playing against were actually only batting with five players. And one of their openers reached 50, retired, and then came back when all of the other players were out. And bear in mind, this is a 20 overs of five balls, so 100 balls in the innings. This guy scored 50, retired, came back in, and ended up scoring 149 runs,
Oh,
which
for
is
God's
pretty
sake.
incredible when you think that there's 100 balls in the entire innings. Anyway. Obviously, that was facilitated more easily by the fact there are only five players, so he came back much more quickly. Anyway, when the innings changed, they said, "Oh yeah, we're going to field with eight. We just decided to bat with five
Oh.
because some of the people just can't bat." And so we very much take this socially. We are not serious in any way, but something like that comes up, and we just ask the umpire, "Okay, well, hang on, what is the rule around this? It's a bit." It seems a bit odd, and this guy's scored 150 and shouldn't have done if those other players had been playing those extra three bats, but because they had soaked up more of the innings. And so we asked the umpire this within earshot of the other side, and at which point this guy from the other team kind of marched over, demanded to know why we were asking, and we sort of said, "Oh, we just want to know what the rules are." We didn't accuse him of cheating or anything. At which point he squared up to one of the kind of meekest members of our team and asked him if he wanted to fight. And this guy on our side kind of looked slightly puzzled him and said, no, I don't. Something obviously got lost in translation here because I certainly don't want to fight. And this guy was just going on and on and on. And what was most worrying was the fact that one of his children, kind of 9 years old, was one of these fielders who was going to come on and field. And you sort of think, well, role model wise, that doesn't really work. And so a lot of our team was up for just saying, "Now let's just abandon this match. We don't really want to play in an atmosphere like this, But we decided in the end, no, okay, we'll go on and we'll go on and play. If you want to field with your full eight, whatever, we'll just get on with it and do it." Throughout their entire innings, this guy was bowling, and he was an awful bowler. He bowled leg spin, a bit like I bowled leg spin, and they're all waist high full tosses. And he kept on getting hit for six, and then just swearing at his fielders on the boundary and blaming them for everything. And it suddenly made me think, it can actually really, really poison the game, particularly at the level that we play at, when you just come against up against those individuals who just have absolutely no sense of perspective whatsoever. So, completely on the opposite from your kind of story, which is really kind of, how amateur cricket really should be, everyone not really taking it very seriously indeed. This was a story from completely the other side of the fence. It's just something completely different.
I think your point is exactly right that it's amazing how one individual can poison a game. It doesn't actually need a lot of people. And I mean, I think we've all had this. I'm lucky to play, I don't really ever play league cricket anymore. I basically always play Sunday casual friendly cricket. And what you realise is that to keep that atmosphere going, it requires everyone being in on it. It requires everyone treating it. And we have it, probably we're quite lucky, maybe just a couple of times a season, you come up against the odd player who just treats the whole thing. I think they just approach the game looking for a fight, looking for a confrontation. And it is really sad how just one individual like that can change the entire mood of a game.
And often it's those individuals who are the ones who just have the most invested in the game as well. Those people who just can't see past winning that game on that occasion, and that is the be all and end all of their life, which is actually quite a sad thing because they are the people who are often a little bit obsessive. Not that we're obsessive running a cricket podcast and everything, but that's different.
There's good obsession and bad obsession, obviously.
from the archives. And for this episode, Andy has picked something that we used to do a lot of at school, and I have to admit I've kind of lost sight of ever since. He's going to be talking to us about a very strange form of dismissal in cricket. He's going to be talking to us about the man cad.
A strange and obviously very controversial form of dismissal. Now, the dismissal that gave the Mankad its name took place when the Indian bowler Vinu Mankad ran out Bill Brown in the second test at Sydney. Now, he'd already pulled off this same dismissal of Brown in an earlier tour match, suggesting that it was very much a trick that he was aware of and looking to use, and perhaps something that Brown was particularly susceptible to. The response was very mixed, so a lot of the press, Australian press, accused the Indian bowler of being unsportsmanlike, but interestingly, Mankad did have a defender of some considerable repute on his side, a certain Don Bradman. Now, Bradman's take on it was, "For the life of me, I can't understand why," this is when he's being asked why it had caused such a fuss, "the laws of cricket make it quite clear that the non-striker must keep within his ground until the ball has been delivered. If not, why is there the provision which enables the bowler to run him out?" Now, I should probably come out early here and say I'm a Bradmanite on this. I've never been quite clear why it's that different to a stumping. You know, you have this thing where the batsman in both instances is gambling with his ground in order to get an advantage. I think if he gets it right, there's an obvious benefit, and if not, there should be a cost.
I think it's interesting that both of the people that we've talked about so far, both Mankad, who obviously did it, and Bradman, who defended it, were both actually batsmen first and foremost. So Mankad is perhaps, you know, other than this, best known for it was an opening batsman who put on an opening stand of something like 500 runs at some point, which was the world record opening stand for quite a long time. And obviously Bradman, a batsman first of all. And it's interesting that it's not just bowlers coming out and saying, "Oh, we need this in order to keep batsmen in check." It's actually batsmen who are coming out and defending this.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction, actually. And I think the point is that much as there was controversy with that very first example of this, or this very first high-profile recorded example of the Mankad, that continues very much this present day. So the most high-profile recent incident took place at the Under-19 World Cup, where West Indies Kemo Paul mankaded Zimbabwean tail-ender Richard Ngarava in the final over of the game to give West Indies a two-run win. And you had Jos Buttler describing it as embarrassing, Owen Morgan called it disgraceful, Darren Lehman, the Australian coach, called it unbelievable. And I think what's fascinating is this is the Under-19 Cricket World Cup. Frankly, most of these players wouldn't have been normally following it or taking any interest. But the fact that the Mankad always elicits such an emotional response means that you have all these high-profile cricket figures piling in. The West Indian captain tried to sort of brush it off, saying it's not a big deal for us, it's probably not in the spirit of the game, but we're happy to have won.
But what's interesting in a game like that is where it's obviously coming down to a very close run chase at the end, it's also probably not in the spirit of the game to be backing up three quarters of the way up the wicket as well. It's, you know, surely that's exactly the point where it does come into its own, where, you know, you need to keep the non-striker in check rather than backing up all the way up the pitch. Because there is, I mean, I always felt it, you know, as I said at the top of the podcast, we used to do this quite a lot at school. It's a bit of a kind of schoolboy trick. And I always used, you know, there was always a bit of a feeling that it was not the right thing to do if someone just accidentally was loitering outside their ground. But it was the right thing to do if someone was kind of clearly taking liberties and deliberately marching way down the pitch before before the bowler had even started their run-up. No. And this seems to be a clear indication of one of those moments where the run chase is really tight. Clearly, it's important that the non-striker is kept in check.
I think it's a great point. I mean, Zimbabwe need three to win in the last over. Obviously, they're going to be looking to sneak a run. I think a lot of this comes down to a lot of the over-response in this situation came down to the fact that it did ultimately decide the game. I think a lot of people, had that happened at another stage in the game, they probably wouldn't have really said anything about it, but people felt it was wrong because, you know, it won West Indies the game. And that highlights a major inconsistency. You know, you can't have a rule of the game that you shouldn't use when it's really important. My theory on this as well is that people have this vision, and a lot of this comes down to the spirit of cricket and all this, but people have a feeling of how a game should end. And for a lot of people, I think this felt like a very anticlimactic way for Zimbabwe to lose a game and ultimately be knocked out of the tournament. But actually, Anticlimactic endings happen. Not every cricket game will be decided with a beautiful six struck down the ground or a wonderful Yorker to dismiss the final batsman. I came across a really good example of how messed up, frankly, the debate and conversation around the Mankad is. The Asian Cup qualifying round for this year's World T20. The Asian Cricket Council beforehand met with the associate teams taking part and instructed them all not to Mankad. Now, Oman's captain promptly ignored this and Mankaded a player from Hong Kong in the
Good
tournament.
on him.
Well, exactly. And I thought this is shows what a mess this debate has got into, where you have a rule that is enshrined in the laws of the game, and yet you have governing authorities telling teams, look, we know it's a rule, but we all think it's a bit unseemly. We'd just rather you didn't do it. And I completely agree with you. Credit to Oman, who are like, well, no, we're going to play this as the rules say it is, and we're going to make use of it if we can.
I would be interested to know because there are other kind of slightly ridiculous rules about how people can be out, like for instance being timed out. And I don't know when the last person someone was timed out in a high-profile game was, but certainly you would understand that you wouldn't want to the World Cup final to be decided on someone's lost their box when they're coming into bat and they get timed out and then oh sorry that's all over and the game is finished. But it does seem odd if there is a sense, and it's interesting, obviously there's nothing clear behind what the Asian Cricket Council, well, why they made this instruction. But I think it seems, as you say, that it's something around is this an entertaining way to play the game somehow, is this a bit of a letdown as a dismissal? We want to see the stumps flying and people taking spectacular catches, not people being subtly run out of the non-strikes. And you think, well, actually, no, it is. It's simply a part of the game, really. You just have to get on with it. I mean, I think we're both pretty firmly on the side of the Mankad in this particular
Yes,
analysis.
yeah. But it's interesting that, we both are, but the game remains very undecided about it. Interestingly, and I was not aware of this at all before researching this item, the laws of the game are actually shifting in favour of the Mankad. Very quick summary, and I also wasn't really aware of this, but the ICC playing conditions are actually what determine the rules under which Test crickets are played under. They are broadly the same as the MCC laws of the game, but there are occasional discrepancies. And the Mankad is an example where there's a discrepancy. So, the current MCC law says that a bowler can attempt a Mankad before entering his delivery stride. Interestingly, the ICC playing conditions say before releasing the ball and provided he has not completed his usual delivery swing. To sum that up, it gives the bowler a little bit more freedom. It's a little bit later in the bowling process that he can run the batsman out, and it means the batsman needs to be alert. Now, we're going through a time at cricket, and maybe cricket always goes through these crises of confidence, and there's one at the moment, I think. Ongoing debate about the imbalance between bat and ball. Particularly in the limited overs format, batsmen are scoring more runs than they've ever had at rates that were unheard of even 5 years ago. And I just wonder whether this isn't a weapon. It's obviously not the only way, but it's one way of returning a little bit of power back to the bowlers. It's one way of giving batsmen something a bit more to worry about. I also think now more than ever, because of this imbalance, we should be less sympathetic to batsmen than we ever have been, really. I think, particularly in the limited overs format, they are the Chris Gayles of this world, wielding these huge bats in a lot of cases on boundaries that haven't changed at all. And I think finally, one thing that never really gets enough recognition, in my opinion, is that it takes a bit of skill. If you are in a delivery stride as a bowler, it takes quite a lot of nous to have the awareness and the temperament to be able to see where the batsman is and have the calmness to remove the bails. So I think, much like any other skill in cricket, we should respect it. To the review, and for this episode, we've been watching How's That? Kerry Packer's War, an Australian drama about the creation of World Series cricket that was released in 2012. Toby, did you enjoy it?
I did actually. I've watched it once before, several years ago when it first came out, and I really enjoyed revisiting it actually, as much as anything, because World Series cricket is something obviously that really genuinely changed the face of cricket forever. I've read quite a lot about it in, you know, in the history books, in the kind of documentary style, reading reports and, you know, people who have analysed it and looked back on it. But there is something really compelling about actually a drama that brings to life, you know, obviously with a bit of dramatic licence and perhaps sometimes in a slightly over-the-top way, but nevertheless brings to life the characters and the real impacts and the real shock of this change. And for that reason, and for the way that that reminds you of how seismic a change this was to cricket and the figures in cricket, it is definitely something that that I think has actually has enormous value.
Yeah, I mean, I also really enjoyed it. I thought it it feels older than it is, and I think it's possibly been left a little bit behind by the fact that so much modern TV is just so good, so much modern drama. And I felt at times you think, God, the dialogue here is a little bit soap opera, but then I kind of felt that that's almost part of the fun. This isn't a drama that takes itself too seriously. It's very keen to bring out the contrasts between the different, well, basically the villains and the good guys in this piece.
And particularly once you get over the fact that here you have all of these people who sort of look like the great cricketers of the day, but don't really look like them. You know, there are a few people who look as if they've got moustaches that have been stuck on slightly badly by the costume team and things like that. But once you actually kind of sort of get over that, then, as you say, it becomes much more kind of convincing.
I thought a lot of those portrayals were fantastic, actually. I thought a lot of the Australian cricketers who I were familiar with, I thought were brilliantly done. I thought Tony Gray was brilliantly done. Obviously, Kerry Packer is the central figure here. And I found his portrayal, I mean, he's very compelling, but also at times it's a little bit confusing. Most of the show he is utterly obnoxious, screaming, bullying everyone in sight, and then occasionally he gets very teary-eyed about the beauty of cricket, and I sort of slightly struggled to square those two.
No, I was just going to say that sometimes the I think, you know, that moment where he goes out into Lords, he's in the middle of negotiating with the MCC to see if they can find some kind of middle ground between their two positions, and he goes out into the middle of the ground at Lords, and he, you know, he looks around him and he says, "This is the heart of cricket, and this is, you know, this is what it this is what it means." And he uses, you know, the same line that the then very conservative chairman of the MCC or whatever position is, you know, "Oh yeah," he says, "cricket is, you know, cricket is a game, but it's so much more than a game." And then in a separate shot, the chairman of the MCC is saying, "The thing about Packer is he doesn't understand that cricket is a game, but it's so much more than a game." And I actually thought that, yeah, it's kind of clunky, but it also kind of works in just demonstrating the complete polar opposites that these two figures and these two worlds were, in the way that they took something that was, you know, quite coherent, the game of cricket and the history of the game of cricket, and they just had such entirely opposing visions for it. And that's what I felt was quite compelling about Packer as a figure, is that he is so much larger than life. He is the brash, fat Australian who's obsessed with money and bullies everyone, as opposed to the genteel, you know, English MCC kind of characters. And it really brought out the fact that this was really a kind of clash of two different cultures.
I think what's interesting is you are always on his side when it's him versus the board members. You always see them. They are portrayed as just self-interested and a block, frankly, on the future and progress of the game. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed. There's a very entertaining montage where World Series has just been announced, and you go from India to the West Indies to Lords, and it's all these cricket board members having their breakfast and their secretaries coming in with the newspaper, and all over the world these board members are dropping their cups of tea. It was absolutely fantastic.
Well, I do think there is something you mentioned the fact that there is a kind of a bit of a bias here, or at least, you know, there is a narrative which is around Packer as the revolutionary with vision acting against a kind of retrograde and regressive cricket establishment everywhere else. I mean, it is, I think, noteworthy the fact that this drama was produced by Channel 9, which was Packer's, you know, the channel that put on World Series cricket and funded World Series cricket in the first place. So in a way, there is a kind of understandable, but something that we need to be cautious of is exactly that degree of hagiography.
But I think they are fair in that at the same time, you're on his side when he's up against the board, but you're very much not on his side when he's basically bullying his long-serving secretary. And I thought a very convincing sequence was right at the very, very end when he's on the phone talking to a business associate about opening a casino. And everyone else in World Series is celebrating, they're excited about this. And you can see for him, he's a businessman. He's moving on to the next venture. And that suggests... that there's a coldness there as well. I thought one thing the series was really good at was on how innovative everything about World Series cricket was. So you have this, and it seems a bit odd to give as much attention to it as the program does, but you have a TV producer from, I think, ABC who is given license to do all the production. And he just goes wild. He's like, let's have stump mics. Let's have... And there's a sort of running joke that he's always adding more cameras. They initially have three and then he says five. And then they say, God, how many have we got now? And he's like, seven. Seven's better than five. Oh, nine's. Nine's better than seven. And as a result, the cost of the venture obviously keeps going up and up and up. And there's also a great sequence where they discover the white ball. So you literally have the Australian players out there in the middle under the lights trying different colours of ball. And they're having it bowled by Dennis Lilly, which is that's some trial, having a ball that you can't see bowled by Dennis Lilly. And they come to the conclusion that the white ball is the one they can see. And I think seeing that sort of innovation is something that the drama portrays really well.
So that's Owls At, Kerry Packer's War. It's available on iTunes for the princely sum of something ridiculous, like £2 or something.
I think it's less than that. I think it's like a cheeky £1.50.
£1.50. It's clearly going to leave you out of pocket. We would recommend it. It's two episodes of about an hour and a half long each, and it does give a pretty fascinating insight into an episode that changed the face of cricket. But it's also just good fun. I think that's the other thing about it. It's just a good way to settle down on a Sunday evening and watch some good drama. Talking of settling down on a Sunday evening and watching some good drama, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this 81st. This is the 81st, 85th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. God, they fly past. As ever, please do let us know on Twitter if you disagree or agree with anything that we've been saying. And most importantly, get on there, because Andy's going to be posting a picture of the duck that he failed to win.